the therapy that you need, baby, right here at home. Get lost in my body and pretend that nothing is wrong.
Quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. Broadcasting from unceded Coast Salish territories, this is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's your next hour of commentary and music.
But we just need one night off to apply that good pressure.
This is part one of a two-part series.
Hi, I'm the wonton noodle soup that has been watered down and doesn't really taste like wonton noodle soup. Like, I'm pretty sure this is chicken bouillon powder, but it's, I don't know. It doesn't hit. My name is Leslie.
Hi, I'm like the stale like pineapple bun that you bought from the bakery, but you decided to eat the egg tart first and forgot about. I'm Gal, local tattooer and artist in SoCal, Vancouver.
Awesome. Yeah, that's our show today. We're very subtly Asian traits happening on the program.
No.
And you're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. CJSF broadcasts on unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam First Nations. And Typically Tuesdays is produced on unceded Catsey, Coquitlam, and Stolo First Nations. Of course, by unceded territories, we mean that these lands were never surrendered, relinquished, nor handed over to either of the states of what we know today to be Canada nor British Columbia. And we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers of this land. With particular regard to today's topic, we make our land acknowledgement while asking some questions. What are Chinese Canadians' relationships to these lands and to the state as racialized and Chinese settlers? How does Chinese settler identity and lived experience complicate the colonial holiday known as Canada Day? How does being Canadian inform how Chinese Canadians navigate solidarity and community with other racialized individuals and Indigenous peoples in Canada? Our conversation tries to explore these topics.
Gal is on the program here with me again today. If you might remember them. I interviewed them a few weeks ago at Good Stank Mart, and today we're going to do a program that I like to call Chinese Canadian Power Hour, in which we're going to talk about just things relating to being Chinese Canadian, kind of. Not that that never happens on the show, that happens every week on the show and sometimes extrally on the show because Jade is also Chinese Canadian, but you know, that's going to be the program today. How are you doing, Gal?
I'm doing good. I love the name of the program. It's a really sunny today. I went to print out my zine and I've been like cutting up the pages and stapling it. So that's most of my day so far. How about you?
I am okay. I am happy that it's not too hot today. It looks like it's actually really, really windy in Poco today. Which is exciting because I don't like hot weather, but I know it's supposed to get a lot hotter in the next few days. And this might be the last that you see of me, Gal. So
there's no wind where I'm at, but I put on sunscreen.
Oh, whoa. Did you put on sunscreen for the tattoos?
Yeah, but like all over my body, even when there's no tattoos on them. But yeah, like I tell all my clients to wear sunscreen. So, you know, I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't put sunscreen on myself.
That's good. I should be more mindful of sunscreen. I'm a bad client in that way. Okay. I feel.
Whether you have tattoos or not, everyone listening now has to put on sunscreen.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you're in your own home, just sitting there. Yeah.
Actually, I learned that like the sun can just like get you even in your home. Like obviously, yeah, because light travels, but I didn't know like you actually should be wearing sunscreen inside.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. Okay. Oh, okay, cool. That's good to know. I learn something new every day. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Kind of like a little bit of the topics that we're going to be discussing today, yes. In which I've already learned too much. That's just how it is. Sometimes you learn about stuff that happens on Tumblr. We're going to be talking about like kind of like being Chinese Canadian from some different perspectives. I myself am a second generation settler. Would you like to share a little bit about yourself as well, Gal?
For sure. I would be fourth generation on my dad's side. My family has both roots from China and Hong Kong, and also just being in Canada for several generations. I don't really know how much else I like really have the intro. I guess like I would say my paternal grandparents were very involved in our local Chinatown, and yeah, there's like some other stuff that like my family talks about, but I'd have to like fact check it a little better before I say anything. Stuff about Barkerville, but that's another topic for another time.
Okay, cool. Yeah, that's fair. So we're going to be talking about being Chinese Canadian. I hope you enjoy that.
We're going to start off with a song. This is Do You Want to Dance by Century Egg. Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. My name is Leslie.
Oh, and I'm Gal.
Yeah, Gal is a local artist and tattoo artist who's here with me today on the program because we're going to talk a little bit about like identity, cultural identity, and stuff like that. The reason why we're doing this show is because on the day we're recording, it's July 1st. It's also known as Humiliation Day among a lot of people, particularly Chinese people and Chinese Canadians living in Canada. So I'm going to read a little bit by Hudson Lin, who wrote just like a very informative piece on the Chinese Exclusion Act to give you a more summarized version of what it is. Hudson writes, "For most Canadians, July 1st is considered the national birthday, but for many Chinese Canadians, July 1st is Humiliation Day, the anniversary of the passing of the Chinese Exclusion Act that tore apart hundreds of families. Passed in 1923, the Chinese Exclusion Act closed the border to any Chinese immigration. This meant that many fathers working in Canada were not allowed to bring over their wives or children. In many cases, these families kept apart by a racist Canadian law for decades. The act was only repealed in 1946. As we recognize Canada Day, let's not forget our country's racist history and its racist present. It's in every province and territory, every government body, every police department, every company and organization. It's systemic, but it shouldn't have to be." And that's why we are here today. Kind of to, we don't have to discuss that topic in particular, but, you know, being children of the diaspora mm-hmm. and experiencing forms of anti-Chinese racism and xenophobia in our day-to-day life, you know, it shapes a person's view of the world and self and stuff like that. For me personally, like, my relationship to the Chinese Exclusion Act is that, like, it did not affect my family. My parents came here in the early 90s, so my family was lucky to not have experienced it. But by the time that I had gotten into high school, it was still not something that was, like, really widely discussed. Mm-hmm. Like, we didn't really learn that. When I was in grade 10, we might have gotten like a blurb, as it is with a lot of public high school education out here. And it is really only in the past couple of years that I've learned a little bit more about it, particularly, for example, like why July 1st is called Humiliation Day, because the act was passed on June 30th. So Chinese Canadians woke up on July 1st and were humiliated. You don't have to go too into it if it's like trauma, but like, do you want to share a little bit about like your thoughts and stuff?
Yeah, my family actually was affected by the Chinese Exclusion Act. I'm not going to go too deep into it, but my family educated me on it, so I was very aware. I would say I didn't really learn about it in like high school social studies very much. We learned about the fur trade and that was it. When it came to the Chinese Exclusion Act, I remember this is when I was still very young, so my memory is a little fuzzy, so hopefully no one like is too harsh on fact checking me. I remember when the Canadian government was urged by protesters to compensate the descendants of those that had to pay the Chinese head tax. I believe the Canadian government was not willing to pay the equivalent of what it would be now for the amount. And so it was it's just a humiliation on top of more humiliation. Also, we shouldn't have to protest for reparations in any sort of way. So yeah. That's my two cents.
Yeah. It's definitely, I really resonate with what you said just now with like, it's humiliation on top of humiliation, right? Mm-hmm. Like first you did this to this community of people and now like they have to like remind you of like, you know, hey, you still refuse to acknowledge this and you still mm-hmm. refuse to like,
compensate us correctly or make up for it. I don't know. I personally find that, like, for me, like, I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe it's like my conspiracy theory brain thinking, but like, I feel like if it were compensated to the amount that it should technically be now with inflation and all that, I would still like have to ask, what more should the Canadian, like, what more can the government do to make up for not only, to make up for that, right? Because, like, yes, resources are good, but also, like, I sometimes feel like, would the government think of it as like hush money?
You know? Oh, I have something good to say. Well, not good. Like, I have something good to contribute in this discourse. I would say, one, you can never pay off like a racist or oppressive act. And so, like, even if the government like was like, here's reparations with, like, you know, inflation equivalent, right? That's not really the end of it. Though I could see certain people would be like, well, you've been paid off, now stop complaining. But I would say that, and these are stories that I've heard that are like passed like down from like mouth, like word of mouth type of passed down stories that my family has told me. A lot of people that were able to pay to have their relatives come over, one, there was a lot of work to save enough money. And thankfully, the community of like current Chinese people who are here, some of them just grouped together and were like, okay, we're going to group our savings to bring your family member over. And like, our family members are still not able to be able to come over. So there have been lots of sacrifices, and families were only able to come here and like eventually like have more generations down the line because of the sacrifice of other Chinese people. And might I add, there's a lot of generations that will never know because some families were never able to come over, and families were permanently broken up. People had to start new lives, unfortunately, because it was lonely for a lot of, usually the men that came over to work and then bring their wives and kids over after. So, and I don't really want to like go off on too much of a tangent, but some men were not able to bring family over, not even for monetary means, but due to Chinatown riots and other things. Some of, you know, our brothers at the time back then disappeared. And you can only assume what happened, you know? But I think it was a sort of anti-Chinese violence that took them away. And so there's a lot of like, there's a huge ripple effect that comes off from the Chinese Exclusion Act that, again, would affect today, because some people never had a chance to bring their family over, have a family, start a family, you know. And yeah, I'm just saying, like, I'm glad our community has resilience and has been able to prosper in some ways by still existing. So even if the government was like, here's the money to make up for everything, you can't undo all the damage that was done. It's literally like, this is all I can do for you. But
yeah,
who knows if the government's going to acknowledge it that way.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from, and I definitely hear you. It's like, when we look at the myriad of histories of, like, you know, like nation states and colonial powers trying to, for lack of a better word, like erase and like kind of like eradicate groups of people, like that's often where they first start, right? Is like separating like the families in some way, you know, classic eugenics and
yep,
is that the term? Yeah, maybe classic eugenics.
but also, yeah, that's just unfortunately the truth of the matter is, like, you know, that is where things start. I wanted to talk to you a little bit, I guess, kind of like, not to hard pivot into a different topic though, but kind of
north,
kind of there. You know, I kind of building on what you're saying about how the Exclusion Act continues to see its legacy right now. I think another way that it does is like just the way that I think its legacy still permeates is in like some things that are sometimes like not very democratic that happen that tend to for whatever reason like affect Chinese communities in particular. For example, like the gentrification of Chinatown and like yes. how residents there get displaced. You know, we mm-hmm. listeners to the show may recall my conversation with Russell Chung from Chinatown Today, but Chinatown Today also you know, wrote a very thoughtful post on social media today discussing the effects of exclusion from the Chinese Exclusion Act. And in that they write, even after the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed, race-based restrictions on Chinese immigration continued until 1967. And today we still see attempts to erase our communities like Chinatown through planned violence of gentrification and displacement. Would you like to share some thoughts on that?
Super well worded. Couldn't have said it better myself. I don't know if I'm going like, it's relevant, but I always just worry that I go off on tangents because how I drone on and on. But I'd like to like pose a question to anyone listening. And I have like put this on social media myself, like on the topic of gentrification and state violence, etc. Okay, in Vancouver, it is not a it's not a new topic that we talk about developments, how everyone in Vancouver is tired of like luxury developments, like let's say Vancouver House, which is like a huge like fancy architectural building who at night I don't see a lot of the lights on. So I'm like, who can afford this? Anyways, so nobody likes luxury developments right now in Vancouver. It's really hard to afford groceries. That is also a common discussion that's happening. And if people, oh, also rent is going up a lot, exponentially. So if people are against like luxury condos, like people can't afford rent, people can't afford groceries, right? Like in Vancouver, Metro Vancouver, just in general, like I don't really see how this is like somehow, like I don't see how this is the go-to for Chinatown in terms of gentrification. I feel like there's just some cognitive dissonance here or some intentional turning the other cheek type of thought process, because we have like, we already have an active community in Chinatown. We have like a lot of low-income seniors on fixed income living in Chinatown. And we have a lot of businesses that are accessible for Chinatown seniors, downtown east side, also accessible for us. A meal in Chinatown is way more affordable for me than a meal downtown. Obvious. No one can contest this. But for some reason, and I don't know if I'm broaching this topic too early in the episode, but you know, 105 Kiefer, there's no reason why we should be supporting this development of luxury condos. What is it? what is it going to do for Chinatown? Because we already have it in, what has it done for Vancouver? You know what I mean? Like, Vancouver House is like so empty. And let's say every unit is bought by someone for this luxury condo at 105 Kiefer. What does that do, right? Like, what does that do for the local community? There's already diminishing grocery stores in Chinatown. So I guess I'm going on so many questions. I'm like, what do you expect seniors living in Chinatown to do when their grocery stores are disappearing if they want to buy groceries? And there's only like expensive boutique grocery stores. Like, they're definitely not able to afford it because groceries are expensive for the regular Vancouver, right? And they're on fixed income. And what are you going to tell the senior to do? Like, oh, like go bus 30 minutes over to Victoria Drive, buy all the groceries you need for the week or like the month and carry it back by hand on the bus. Like, I don't even like carrying groceries on transit myself, and I'm an able-bodied young person. You know what I mean? I'm going off on like, I'm just going off, and I'm speaking very colloquially and not like necessary so academic wise. So I know like that can be a little jarring for some people, but I just think it's a very simple concept that everyone should get. I don't think necessarily tourism is the key to revitalize Chinatown. And I'm not saying I'm against tourism, but I don't see how tourism goes hand in hand with forgetting about our most vulnerable and marginalized groups. You know what I mean? If your revitalization of Chinatown does not include harm reduction and it actually promotes harm to the local community, then that's not revitalizing Chinatown. And that's just my opinion.
Yeah, I definitely see where you're coming from there. And I agree in many ways. Two of the things that stood out to me with what you were saying was the question about groceries, right? Like, how are Chinatown seniors able to, like, how are they going to be able to afford groceries? Well, the thing is also, like, transit is... it can be quite difficult for people to access public yes. transportation as well. Not to reveal too much about myself, in my workplace, most of our clients are low-income newcomers, and we regularly have like a cache of bus tickets that our organization purchases for the specific use of our clients. And we go through them super quickly because for a lot of people, they can't really afford to get like a 3-zone monthly bus pass every single month, right? Even 1-zone when it's, how much is it right now? Maybe something close to $100. I haven't checked since today they changed the transit fares, but a lot of people who are on very fixed income, you know, like, if they're getting only a couple $100 a month on their pension, that is expensive for them. The other thing that I really resonated with you on is like this question of like, you know, why is it okay for luxury condos to be developed in Chinatown when residents don't like them getting developed anywhere else? And the thing that I suddenly thought of was like, maybe it is an issue with how Chinatown has been framed for a while, I would say probably for the past like 15 or so years as a tourist destination. I think I remember being in middle school. It must have been around the time we had the Winter Olympics in Vancouver. So about 2010. And I was delighted to see like the street banners, you know, on like lights They had like this cute little panda, and it was like tourism Chinatown or something like that. And at the time I was like, oh, it's a cute little panda. That's nice. But I had never really, like, for me, I remember thinking, I didn't know people thought of Chinatown as a tourism destination. I didn't know that people toured Chinatown. Like, my folks come here to, like, get medicinal ingredients and sometimes to, like, buy hardware appliances and things like that. And there are other people living here, but I didn't really understand what was so touristy about it, because it was a neighborhood to me. It was a
Sorry to interrupt, but that's exactly what it is. It's like Chinatown is a neighborhood first before it should be a tourist destination. Like, I'm not saying like we should just, you know, abolish tourism and tourism does nothing for Chinatown, but I am saying, hey, there are real people here. There's, you know, real people living here, real people who have long-standing businesses, and some of these long-standing businesses may, you know, benefit from tourism, but they also still benefit from the local population. And you can't just forget the local population and be like, oh, well, we're only doing this for tourism means, because then it there's no humanity in it, if you ask me. And if it becomes solely tourism based, then are we just putting on a show and a facade of what is Chinese? Yeah, if we only invest in tourism for Chinatown, then we're not investing in the culture actually. It's not genuine. It's just a show. It's a show for someone to come visit Chinatown for a day or however long they want to if they're vacationing. And, you know, with new developments, maybe they'll get an Airbnb and be like, wow, it's so cute, and then just leave. And what does that do for people who are living here, who would be contributing long term their whole lives, like long before we were born and continually now? Like, do those people not count, right? Is tourism and creating this like display of what is Chinese for this person who's going to only be here for a day or 5 days, like, really that much more like important? And I also think, I don't know, I have like a weird, not weird, I have a very complicated, nuanced perspective towards tourism, because tourism can be quite harmful. And to do a very like just a quick mention that makes it very easy and obvious, vacationing in Hawaii is extremely harmful to local residents. We don't need to go into that. People can just Google that, but that's a very much discussed topic that has a lot of discourse online. That's a good example of why tourism needs to be nuanced, or it can be extremely harmful.
Yeah, that really makes me think of, to kind of like borrow a little bit of some of Chinatown Today's writings on this subject. Like, the people who go to Chinatown who might live in the luxury condo, or who might just like spend a few days there to visit, a lot of the times they're not even supporting legacy businesses or anything like that, right? So like, in many ways, like, having more foot traffic in Chinatown does not guarantee that it is going to be beneficial for the residents or the businesses there, particularly the ones that have been there for several decades. The other thing that I think I thought of was a little bit about our conversation that we had privately a few nights ago about like what types of signifiers represent Chinese culture and Asian culture, and how so much of that, a lot of those signifiers, for example, such as like food memories or like holiday memories or things like that, like they have a lot of significance towards us, but we see that it becomes so commodified a lot of the times that it might end up pandering towards like non-Chinese people, non-Asian people, particularly white people. And that kind of ends for, you know, many people, that kind of ends up becoming like their selling point or their shtick, even though they can be doing some other things that are still cultural and are still like relevant to their interests.
In terms of like what you just said, I want to talk about like what are identifiers of culture. And since, you know, I'm an artist, and I've interacted with the local artist community, I will say like, and there's no like right or wrong way to do art unless you like sell out. That's a totally different topic, but we're not talking about that. Like I have like a food series pieces that I have as prints, and it's usually different types of meals, and I call it like the anatomy of dim sum, the anatomy of siumei, which is like Chinese barbecue, anatomy of hot pot, it's just like I draw different elements of that type of meal, and then at the bottom I list out what they are. What I want to do that is like, I think it's like very fun. People love to see art that is like kind of like an unpacking, like I don't know, like you put out different items basically on this grid that fits to the theme. But I wanted to take it a step further and like add a bit of education. And I keep I speak Cantonese, so I keep like the Cantonese pinyin there, and then with like, you know, translate in English for what that is. And I want that to be educational because I love that people like to share culture through food, but I don't want it to stop there, because it's like, oh, I like your food, but I think like your culture is like so loud and stuff. Like, I love eating, I don't know, like I love eating dim sum, but why is this table beside me like so loud? It's like very rude. And I'm like, that is a very closed-minded westernized perspective, right? And I'm like, listen, you know, if you're gonna enjoy our food, you can also learn to enjoy being around us. That said, I also want to say, like, any artists that do like just food without like, you know, educational text, done nothing wrong with that. I'm just saying like what I like to do, and I want to just take a step further, and that's like a little gentle nudge hopefully for people to be like, yo, this is cool. And I made a joke that if like I made a joke with my art collective that like if you're like not savvy in Chinese food, but say like you really like want to try dim sum, you can take my like print with you, like the postcard side version, and then just bring it to dim sum and be like, can I have what's listed here? Easy peasy. Or, you know, if you happen to be, you know, like a non-Chinese person dating someone Chinese and you want to impress the family, you know, be like, I can order for the table, and then look at my print underneath the table and be like, let's get some hagao and some siumai. And then, you know, everyone's like, wow, it's so cool, you're so smart, you know our food. But actually that means you're actively just trying to do better and learn, which is better than just being someone who's like, oh, I love sushi, but I don't eat the raw fish. California rolls are really good, and so are avocado rolls. And I'm like, I don't think you know.
Yeah, California rolls are explicitly not Japanese and also not from California, apparently, yes. Right? So yeah, I really see where you're coming from with that. Food is, it's so interesting because I feel like it being like a thing of like many people's lives and stuff like that. Like that
everybody
is,
eats.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's how we like kind of connect with our families and all that. And it can be such a personal experience, and often to see that it has been commodified. If I go on to Amazon, I can find like, I don't know, like many stickers about random Asian foods. And it's like, this is kind of like the kind of cute little gimmick that we're trying to sell, cute little soy sauce bottles. It feels a little bit like empty, you
know? Yeah, like I'm not going to stop my fellow Asians from, you know, getting that bag. I'm not going to stop my fellow Asians from, like, you know, with their art business and all that. But, like, in terms of who's consuming it, I don't know. I feel like it's important to keep that in mind. It's like when I have conversations and I might make a joke that's like a Chinese related joke. I'm not going to necessarily make that joke to someone who's white. I make it to someone who's Chinese that understands that this is a joke because we experience our culture the way it is. Like, I could, like, let's say I make a joke like, hey, you know, sometimes after dinner, I feel like being that uncle that as soon as he's done eating, gets up, sits on the couch, doesn't talk to anyone, doesn't put his bowl away. You know, that's a joke that I can talk about that people would get. And, you know, it's just me talking about how I just want to be kind of lazy. But if I said it to someone outside, they might be like, wow, are you like Chinese uncles like that? That's so rude. I would never do that at home. My uncles never do that. They always, like, I don't know, you know what I mean? And it's like, if you're going to produce something, and I'm not trying to be on a high horse, it is really good to also remember that different people are going to consume your work and how they're going to consume it, right? Just harm reduce, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Commodification makes everything just a lot harder to deal with in life, you know.
Yeah.
As it is. It is the time.
There is no ethical consumption under modern day capitalism. But that doesn't mean we can't do our best.
So many things that are interrelated to being a person of the Chinese diaspora living in Canada. It's July 1st on the day we're recording this. It's Humiliation Day. We are discussing some of the complicated things around Canada and being a Chinese person living in Canada and such. And it's a good time. It's really great. We are basically shoulders deep in this conversation at this point. I really do want to talk a little bit about what you're doing for Chinatown Gal, because you've been doing some really, you know, you've been doing some really great work around raising awareness towards gentrification in Chinatown, asking a lot of very relevant and challenging questions that many people who aren't as engaged with the issue should be asking. You have ways for people to show up right now for Chinatown residents. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
For sure. So with what I heard about, like, the 105 key for developments, it was very upsetting that, you know, we're going to go ahead and build luxury condos. I actually spent a few days crying about it, amongst some other similar topics branching off of that affected me. I was really upset and conflicted about some other stuff that was still relevant to this topic. And I, like I said earlier, I like my art to, when I am doing something that's relevant to, like, life right now, I want to make it educational. So I made, like, a little comic that I'm turning into a zine, just about one of my memories in Chinatown, and that has to do with gentrification and how that is relevant and very frustrating and upsetting to me about 105 Kiefer right now, in hopes that, like, people will read it and understand my perspective. Like, I have so many opinions, and I've been in activist circles and in social justice dialogue, like, privately, but I've never been super public because I'm just scared of the internet and people recognizing me in real life. But this time I decided to post, and I wanted to start off the conversation easy, so I made it personal, because it's a personal story that's not anything people can contest. And my focus was to highlight the struggle that Chinese people have faced in Canada, and that this development of luxury condos is added on to that history, but right now, and who that affects, which is like our senior population in Chinatown. And I want to focus on the topic of all this like cool, fun gentrification stuff that people think is cool and fun is really harmful. And I'm in my zine, I feel like I'm not shouting at the reader, I'm pleading with the reader, like, you know, please. And I don't want to plead, I'd rather shout, but I'm going from the education aspect in hoping that, you know, that will help educate people so they understand. That said, I don't want people to tone police anyone who is like vocally angry about what's happening, because you should be. And in a lot of civil rights movements in the past, it was not necessarily peaceful, because you'll just get bulldozed by people in power. So like, sorry, going off on tangent, I want to make sure that when I talk about my stuff being educational, and that I'm trying to have people empathize with me, I don't want people to use this statement of mine to be to weaponize it on people who have been actively advocating for Chinatown and Chinatown senior population, and saying you should be just as palatable as Gal. Because I don't think you need to be palatable to tell someone that you're harming a community. I'm just not used to being very public, so I decided to do something that is more personal and emotional. And while I actually think it's quite palatable, I've learned it's not palatable to certain people. And I was shocked, because I'm like, I didn't mention anything bad about like anyone, unless you identify as a gentrifier, then I guess. But that's on you. But anyways, like, this scene I'm making, is going to be something that I'm selling. It's going to be pretty like low cost, so it's accessible to people. But this scene, along with all of my art at one of the upcoming markets, is going to like all 100% of proceeds are going to go to Yarrow Society. And I'm donating to Yarrow because, it is youth and senior led, and they have always been advocating and effectively, mindfully, and positively impacting Chinatown. And everything they do is essentially what we need to revitalize Chinatown, in my opinion. Yarrow Society is nuanced in their thinking, their actions, they're effective, they're educational. They, like, for example, like, one thing Yarrow does is that they have volunteers go and take seniors to doctor's appointments and to help translate. Sometimes that's not accessible for some seniors, right? They don't know where to go. They might not like be able to access a doctor who speaks like Cantonese, Mandarin, Toisan, any of the many Chinese dialects, because we're not a monolith. And I'm like, who else is doing that, you know? If you don't have a family member to do that for you, who else is doing that? And I think Yarrow is very much deserving of more funding. And yeah, for whatever sales I make, I'm going to match it up to $200, because full-time artist, tattoo artist, and the economy is not doing so well, but I will be matching it. I'm matching whatever I make up to $200, and that's all going to go to Yarrow. And for my zine, when I sell it at other markets in the future, I'm going to be just like saving up whatever I make on those zines to also just go to Yarrow, because I want this to be continued support and not just like a one-time thing.
Yeah, definitely. That's, I really relate with you. I really sit with you in the feelings of sadness finding out that 105 Kiefer, the development, was passed. I also sit with you in the feeling of like
not wanting to feel like I need to plead for people to pay attention to this. But instead that it should just be a thing that people should know. I shouldn't have to feel like I'm begging anybody to do it. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, a development that was proposed, like, I think almost 10 years ago. People have been like pushing back against it for nearly a decade, right? Like, I was still in high school.
And the message is cleared. We don't want it.
Yeah. And it's been, you know, quite disappointing that it has been passed anyways. And listeners, I have read this zine. It's really good. It's, you know, a very personal and also very thoughtful account and story of the harms that gentrification does to places like Chinatown that are cultural spaces that have continued to thrive because of its residents, and how gentrification will ultimately affect them and has a very high potential of displacing them from the very place that they have been able to survive in. I think as I talk, the word that keeps coming up for me regarding like the passing of this development has been insult. It's like, it's such an insult to the face, I think, because thinking about how, I guess tying it back to our conversation that we had earlier today about like tourism in Chinatown, right? Chinatown is a tourist destination. This is a historical space in Vancouver. This is like, this is part of what has made Vancouver, Vancouver, because of its geography, but then also because of the many laborers who lived there, the many families that lived there that helped develop Vancouver into what it is, that has also helped develop Vancouver through helping its own community, right? And it has been very upsetting to see how that has it has been very upsetting to see how this development has just continued to live and thrive somehow. I do have many hopes that there will be work to be done to turn it into a social housing unit and a fully social housing unit.
I hope so.
Yeah, which is what many activists are trying to push for right now.
Sign the petition.
Yeah, sign the petition. It is there. It exists. It will be in the show notes later this week when this episode goes up. But I really have to commend you, Gal, for sharing your story and for your vulnerability in this zine. So you are going to be selling it at a market very soon and in upcoming markets. When is it going to make its print debut?
Actually, I'm going to be... I actually have a market right before, like, the big market, I guess, that I'm doing the fundraising for. So the first market I'll be at is going to be July 8th, and it's the New West Market. It's from 1 to 9 p.m., so it's like a night market of sorts. That zine will be there. That's the debut. But the day I'm donating, like, all proceeds of, like, any sales I make and, like, of any print is going to be on July 9th for Community Days at Sun Yat-sen Gardens. I also have... an artist friend who will be donating some copies of her most popular print as well for this fundraiser. And I have a few other artists that want to participate either in just like donations or providing some of their like artwork for the table. So we will see.
Yeah, I recall you mentioning that you wanted to
organize something with other local artists for mm-hmm. your fundraiser. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? And if there's a listener who's interested in supporting, how can they contribute?
Yeah, I think there's like a way to do it like together or like separately together. I don't really want to put pressure on anyone because I think it's like just constraints. And if anyone has capacity, like if anyone wants to donate prints, I'd be happy to sell them on that day and we donate all proceeds. Of course, those artists will be credited and I will like have a little QR to each person's like website, Instagram, etc. Another great thing to do is if you would prefer not to provide prints for the market at Sun Yat-sen Gardens, is that if you do your own fundraising or if you do raffle and then we can all donate it to Yarrow, but it can be on social media as a joint effort to just notify more people, right? Because we all have different followings, etc. It's really up to everyone on how they want to. I'd love to get in touch and like also just have that discourse going. And I think the more that people see that different artists are like connecting together on this topic, the more relevant it becomes, you know?
So how can people contact you?
They can get me on Instagram on Lucky Munyi, so LUCKY.MUNYI. Just send me a DM there.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Gal, yes. For that information, for your zine, and for your time. I'm so grateful for your time today and also for the work that you do. Lots of people should get behind it. So check out Gal's work and all that good stuff. We're about to wrap up pretty soon. Do you have any final thoughts?
Yes, I do. Thank you. You were speaking on the development and it brought us some thoughts and I want to just like springboard off of it. So I just really want to mention really quickly that I don't want us to only label us as in the community. I don't want us to label this as only as like this development is being racist towards Chinatown. It's also very, very classist. And to people who may believe that development of luxury condos like this are to make Chinatown safer, I ask you, safer to whom? To whom? And even if you say, oh, safer for the Chinese seniors to like walk around like in their own neighborhood, and I will say they've been walking around their own neighborhood their whole lives. I think taking up space for developments for profits is actually dangerous to them. So unless you have a short-term, long-term, detailed plan about how this development is going to proactively and effectively, exponentially help the community in Chinatown without causing any harm, I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah, I think that is a very fair argument to have. We can talk about this off air because I think it would be a lot to add on to. But there have already been, as I recall, like hearing from the news and like and the talks at the development board, like there have already been folks who have experienced firsthand the harm that the actual institutional harm of having more of these luxury condos and increased policing of the neighborhood directly affecting the residents. So thank you so much for pointing that out as well. I think we're hitting the top of the hour. So we're gonna close off the show now. But again, thank you so much, Gal, for your time. Tune into more great CJSF programming by checking out Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon every Friday from 10 to 11. Your host, Charlotte Sista C. Farrell, always has a really good show happening about arts and writing, and actually also a lot of her work centers around local seniors. So check that out every Friday from 10 to 11, Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon. I've been Leslie.
And I'm Gal.
And thank you so much for tuning in. I'll catch you on the flip side as in next week. Okay, bye.